Hi, my name's Ken. I'm an alcoholic. I thought I was going to get one more reader. Okay, let me time myself. We don't want to be here all day. I want to thank Tammy for inviting me to come out to your conference, and it's really nice to be here. I had no idea it was such a large conference. Oftentimes when I do these Saturday at 2 things, there's, you know, a room this size but with about 6 people in it. So this is really nice, only because not that I don't like an audience. That's a lie. Of course, we all like audiences for alcoholics, right? But I find that I'm pretty scared to do this, and I can kind of get lost in the crowd, and I certainly identify with Debbie's fear up here. One of my biggest fear, I was mute in AA for 2 years. I was 2 years sober before I ever opened my mouth in a meeting to read, to share, to do anything. I was really, really scared. I did not come here and feel like I was home by any stretch of the imagination. But I've been taught through strong sponsorship that, you suit up and you show up, and I come from that school if you don't turn down an AA request. And as a result of doing that and walking through my fears, I have a really good life today. And every good thing that I have in my life, I have learned through you, through your example, and through doing it here first. And I want to thank you, the committee, for the corsage. And it is kind of like in the corner of my eye. I still, I kind of those old like flashback days where you kind of still see things. So if you see me like hitting at it, just remind me it's just the corsage. There's a story in my home group about a bunch of sober guys playing softball, and a guy that he was slipping in and out. He came up to bat, and he was just about to bat right as a big swarm of gnats came around it, and he just stood there paralyzed until somebody yelled out, "We see him too!" And then he relaxed. So it's so nice to be amongst our own kind. You know, I love that. You know that I guess only an A would that be funny. I'm really happy to be here. I'm a little bit off. I had the pleasure of going to a conference in Australia, and I just got back on Wednesday, and then you know how we are. We got a too much fun, and worked Thursday and Friday, and flew to Phoenix Friday and drove here this morning, and so I'm a little bit I don't know what I am, but I'm just going to try and talk from the heart. And I'm really sorry that I missed my beloved Karen's talk last night. Karen was my sponsor for 7 years, and she absolutely changed my life, and I'm really honored to share this podium with her. Anyway, I was born. I'll start there. I want to thank you for the water. Not one, but 2 bottles. Very happy about that. I grew up in an alcoholic home in Northern California in Santa Cruz. Born to alcoholic parents, I don't know that that necessarily makes me an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because as an old-timer that I love says that alcohol fixes something in me that I need fixing. And I've just never heard it described any better than that. Alcohol fixes something in me that I need fixing. But this home that I guess to a certain extent were products of our environment. And this house that I grew up in, it was, kind of your, it wasn't the worst alcoholic home, but it wasn't, it had its It had its ups and downs, I guess. We're the family whose garbage cans stayed out all week. There's always one of those on every block. And, sometimes the phone would be cut off or the power would be cut off. Lots of broken windows at our house. One of our family stories is the glass man had been there for like the third time in a week. And as he was leaving to repair a window, and as he was leaving, he stuck his head back in the front door, and he said to my mom, "Lady, you're the captain of a strange ship," and out he went. And that kind of sums it up right there. Before I forget, there's something that's really important that I need to do, and I want to welcome any of our new members. I want to welcome any newcomers that are here. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to invite you to stay with us, and I always love to say this because I believe it absolutely. I want you to know, if you haven't figured it out yet, that there is absolutely something extraordinary about what you are sitting in. If I was in this room alone with 15 years of sobriety, that's a long time between cocktails for somebody like me. And I only know one other person's story in this room. But I know that, we bring all kinds of insanity and hell and all kinds of craziness, that hopelessness and despair. We come from those conditions. And yet here we all are. And we're cleaned up and we're sober and we're appropriate and we're kind to one another and we're compassionate. And, we're not, since we're in a casino, we're beating those odds. Just really shouldn't happen. But they do happen here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new again, I'd like to, invite you to stay and avail yourself of what is in this room. So I grew up in this kind of wacky house. Did I stop my watch? Okay. My story's really simple. I'm one of those Irish Catholic girls that just kind of, had a cocktail and went to feed. I didn't drink for very long. I was 22 when I got sober, but I, had all the fun I could stand. My father was a truck driver. He was a novelist gaining experience as a truck driver, but we know how that goes, and he retired as a truck driver. He was gone for long stretches of time, and sometimes he'd return with strange vehicles, and you just never knew kind of what was going to be up with him. And my mother was the one that held it all together. I have three siblings, and she was a local librarian in our town, and so she would certainly have her breaking points. And I love to tell the story about my mom. There was a leaky faucet at the library where she worked, and she would put up with a lot, but when she snapped, that was it. And they didn't fix this leaky faucet in time, and one day she snapped, and she called down to City Hall and said, "If you don't get someone here to fix this leaky faucet, I'm going to run New Dunwoodrow Avenue with a sign around my neck that says I work for the city of Santa Cruz and I've been driven mad by a leaky faucet." So this is, my gene pool here. I am intense and fearful by nature. That's just kind of, who I am. And that doesn't rule me anymore, but it's still, I have to respect the fact that I have a disease, and I respect the fact that the forces that brought me here are still very much with me. So what I need to do is I need to treat my alcoholism aggressively, and I do that by really staying in the middle of you. When I took my first drink at about 14, I should tell you that a couple of things I should tell you. One, that my debt to Alcoholics Anonymous is enormous. I have a fantastic life, but AA was working in my life before I ever picked up a drink because my grandfather was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unfortunately, he died right when I started to drink, and we'd have an awful lot to talk about. My father left when I was 10 or 12 or something like that. He didn't go far. He just went down the street with another woman and her children. Only in AA would that be funny, but I love that we bring the stuff here and we just laugh about it. So when my father left, and my mother was, left with these four children to raise alone on a librarian salary, and it was very difficult, and it was my grandfather who saw that, we got braces on our teeth, and he helped my mother make the house payments, and he paid the tuition so we could stay in Catholic school, and I imagine that he was making some kind of living amends. He was a father figure to us, but he had not been able to be a father figure to my father because he was drinking, and had he not been sober, it would have been a lot rougher, and I'm really indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous on more than one level. At any rate, when my dad left, it really set up quite a resentment in me, and I just bring that up because there were a couple things that were taken from me when I got to AA, as if they never were. One was the obsession to drink. It was lifted from me in a hospital emergency room. And the other was the way that I felt about my dad. It was just a gift free and clear that I got here through working the steps. I have a really good relationship with him today. He talks about my magic, and he knows what it is. He knows that it's AA. Unfortunately, he hasn't found it for himself. But he's very happy with what you've done with me, I want you to know. I picked up that first drink at about 14, and I don't, need to go into that really much. You know my journey, and it just worked for me, and I understood instantly why my parents drank, and I, went back quickly for another one, and I was just to kind of give you an idea of what my drinking was like. I progressed pretty quickly. Around that time, I was graduating from the eighth grade, and like I said, I went to Catholic school, and I don't mean to offend anyone, but I love Catholic school. I don't think I'm recovering from that experience. I'm grateful for the education I got there. And I think, too, because there was not a lot of structure in my home. And I'm just kind of lost. You know, the world is a frightening and foreign place to me. And I knew what to wear and I knew what to do. And I felt that I had a good connection with that faith and with that Catholic God. And I bring that up because that was one of the first things that had to go when I started drinking use, because of the stuff that I was doing and principles that I was breaking. And I have to turn my back, or I thought I did. I have to turn my back on a God and on a faith that gave me a great deal of comfort in order to pursue my drinking. Anyway, when I graduated from the eighth grade, the morning after my eighth grade graduation, I came out and my mom was at the kitchen table and she had my diploma and I won some little pins and things, and she said to me, "Ken, I finally got my scholar." And I can tell you that about a year and a half later, I was standing in front of my mom again, except this time I was behind the counter at the local Berliner Schnitzel, where I was working full-time. I had dropped out of high school with a 0.8 GPA. And she was there because I hadn't been home in a couple days. And she would go to where I drank or where I hung out or where I worked to see if I was all right. And she was standing there trying not to cry and saying to me, "You know, I don't understand what's happened to you. You used to be so active." You know, I didn't understand it either. It's quite clear to me today. I'm one of those alcoholic women that I took the drink and the drink took me. But I didn't know what was happening at the time. I couldn't, you know, relate the chaos in my life to my drinking. And I'll tell you, a restaurant career, you know, I did not, if you would have asked me when I was graduating from the eighth grade, where will you be in a year and a half, behind the counter at the Berliner Schnitzel, hungover, was not on my agenda. You know, I can remember coming home, I'd stay out and just the guilt and the remorse. And I can remember one morning, you know, some guy had dropped me off. My mom hadn't gone to work yet and I just couldn't face her. And I was wearing my clothes from the night before and I had him drop me off around the corner. I remember sitting on that curb and just, you know, sick and shaking and feeling terrible and knowing she was in the house worried. And you know, I couldn't stop. And I came in the house and there was a note from her on the refrigerator that said, "Don't you realize what it does to me when you do this?" And of course I did, you know, of course I did. But there just didn't seem to be anything I could do about it. Except that I took my first geographic. I went off to Honolulu. I had an older sister who was living there and practicing our disease, and it seemed like my friends could just party on the weekends and end up back at school. And I wasn't able to do that. And I thought it must be them, it must be this town, it must be this high school, and you know, maybe it'll be different somewhere else. And of course, you know, wherever you go, there you are. It wasn't any different there. In fact, it was worse. We ended up losing our apartment, and you know, we're these two. My sister was 19, I guess I was 15 or so. She had a little baby boy, was about 6 months old, and we were staying on friends' couches. And I can remember one Easter, getting off the bus on an Easter Sunday with everything that we owned in pillowcases, you know, going to yet another friend's floor to stay on, and just kind of thinking like, something's not right here. This is not the way it was supposed to be. Things got worse there, and I got drunk and I got pregnant in that order, and I terminated that pregnancy. And I'm not here to moralize about that for anybody but me, but the year before that I'd been confirmed in the Catholic Church, and that faith that meant a great deal to me. And I found myself very early on into my drinking, having to drink to cover up the stuff that I had done while I was drunk, and I was on that merry-go-round, and that, you know, I could not have called it pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, but when I heard those words here, I knew exactly what that was, and that had been a companion for a long time. I decided that I would, you know, get back to California. It would all be different. I would just forget about Hawaii, and that was always to be this pattern that I established about I've got to get back, and I don't know, you know, where getting back was. I mean, there's to some pre-alcoholic state, I guess, but it, of course, you know, it doesn't work that way. We just have to proceed through the disease. But I kind of chased that if I, you know, somewhere else, it would be all right. It would be better. I could stop this. And I went back to California. This is when my restaurant career started at the Berliner Schnitzel. And I didn't know that I was to, you know, work in restaurants for the next 17 years and the first 11 years of my sobriety. And There's absolutely, you know, nothing wrong with that, except it's just never what I planned on doing. I was never happy doing it. Kind of was just going to be, you know, just a temporary job, and that's not, you know, my friend Marianne says that she often didn't know the difference between a fantasy and a plan. And that was certainly the case for me, not knowing the difference between a fantasy and a plan. And I carried that with me for a long time into sobriety as well. You know, I was always just kind of waiting for my real life to start. And anyway, I started working at the Winner Central, and, you know, around the time I met him, and we all have one of those, at least one, Mr. Wright. He's currently Mr. G85602, the warden at Soledad, but at the time, you know, he seemed very charming, very charismatic. And furthermore, he didn't bug me about my drinking, you know. He didn't say things like other dates said, like, what are those flash marks on your wrist? And, you know, my mom says you can't come over anymore, and you smell like a brewery, and why are you shaking? You know, he didn't bother him in the least. So I was in love. And, you know, that relationship got violent quickly, and you know, once again, just kind of, you know, this isn't what I planned. And before I knew it, I was stealing money from that Gerwina Schnitzel and giving it to him, and he was, you know, buying drugs for us. Of course, he didn't work. And I ended up losing that job. Even Gerwina Schnitzel has their standards, I want you to know. Not easy to do. I don't believe I was fired. I think I quit right before they fired me. But I'd been drinking on the beach all day, and I showed up there and got into an altercation with another employee in the parking lot. And we both ended up rolling around in the parking lot. And then I walked through the back door and you know, made a scene behind the counter. And just, you know, my drinking is really just a series of very small humiliations. I can remember after I dropped out of high school, I had tried going to this prep high school. I went to several different high schools. I think the second to last one I went to was this prep high school, and I thought, you know, this will be better. And I was went to at my church, and again, you know, again trying, you know, I try and go back to church, and I went to some sort of a festival. And unfortunately, I knew the people that were running the wine cooler booths. And you know, just, it hadn't been long before, like I said, I'd been really active in that school and in that parish. And I ended up getting into a screaming match with my former principal from that prep high school. And, you know, everyone is just, you know, watching, you know, all the nuns and priests and everyone in the parish. And as I then turn on my heel and march up the steps of the parish hall, and just, you know that expression, the ground rose up to meet you. I know what that means, because suddenly, you know, the cement was just right on my face. Just, you know, that's just never what I intended to happen when I just wanted to relax with a glass of wine. I lost the Gerwina Schnitzel job, or I quit, whatever happened in between there, and I went across town to the Great American Wiener Works. There's a theme here, just in case you haven't noticed. And they serve beer. So that was a step up, and before I know it, I'm, you know, loading cases of beer out the back door and what have you. It was just getting uglier, and it wasn't, you know, the blackouts weren't so cute anymore. I didn't want to hear, you know, what I'd done the night before, et cetera, et cetera. And I couldn't get away from this guy, and that was getting crazier. I had a bad week, I guess I can just put it that way. I had this car. I didn't know how to drive when I bought the car, and of course, I, you know, no insurance, no license, you know, no registration, none of that. I couldn't figure out how people did that kind of stuff. I really couldn't. And some of the greatest gifts that I've gotten here have been those, what may be the simplest things to everybody else, but to me they're really, really big deals, you know. I just didn't know how people did that kind of stuff. You know, I can remember going to try and get birth control, for example, and you know, and then they'd always ask, well, what was the first day of your last period? And I would think, well, who would know that? You know, I couldn't, like, it all seemed too much. At any rate, I had this car. It took me forever to learn how to drive it because it was a stick shift, and, you know, I was always loaded, and I couldn't get the motor skills down. And I ended up crashing it in a blackout one night, and I didn't know what had happened, and I found myself looking through the newspaper the next morning to see if I'd hit anyone or killed anyone, if the police were looking for anyone, and, you know, not a really pleasant morning after feeling. And I can remember reading, because I'd always been a reader, maybe in Ann Landers or something, that was a sign of alcoholism, and it, you know, kind of set off a little flag. And within this same period of time, week or so, I was beaten really badly by this guy, and you know, one of those kind of hostage situations that, you know, sound kind of exciting in theory, but when they're actually happening, it's somehow I thought, no, this isn't quite how I thought it. I mean, he seems so exciting to me. He's so edgy. Until they throw you out of a moving car, and then anyway. So I, you know, these two events conspired, and I just, they happened around the same time, and I thought, you know, suddenly Hawaii didn't look so bad after all. And I put that car in my mother's garage, and I closed the door on it. You know, it never occurred to me that, you know, I mean, I just literally left the wreckage of my past in her garage. And I bought a one-way ticket back to Hawaii, back to the place I said I'd never go. And I was 18 by this time, and drinking age was 18 in Hawaii. At the time was 18. I got a job in a bar. We had $1.50 drinks, four bands a day, and two Elvis impersonators. And I had a lot of fun. I really loved working in that bar. But you know what? I'm just crossing those lines, I haven't been there very long. And I overdosed on LSD, and I'm, you know, drugs are a small part of my story, but to the core, I'm an alcoholic. But I ended up in a psych ward on like a 24-hour hold, and that really, really frightened me. I was not afraid to die, I don't think, but I was really afraid to live and be crazy. And I decided to clean up, which was, you know, which ended up being just alcohol and cocaine use daily. I know, but you know, it's like health food, right? And I'm very grateful for the cocaine because it got me here faster. I've no doubt that it accelerated my alcoholism. But by the time I'm 19, I'm on my fourth abortion. And how does that happen? And I tell you, I never planned on living that way. You know, I never did. And I'm now so far removed from any kind of God of my understanding or what I feel is any kind of grace or any kind of redemption. And, you know, when you're severed from a spiritual connection, you're severed from a human connection. I can remember that intense loneliness that I lived in. And I ended up having an affair with a married man. He was one of the Elvis' bass players, and that was a big no-no. He wasn't leaving his wife the way I thought he should, and I didn't, you know, I had no concept of commitment and what that meant, and I decided to punish him, and I went to China, and which made a lot more sense at the time. I know it doesn't, you probably don't see the connection now, but but actually, I'd always, like I said, I'd always been a reader. I'd always had a very active imagination, as most of us do. I think one of the phrases that describes me best is that the alcoholic is in full flight from reality, and that was certainly the case with me. I had always pictured myself as having this exotic coterie of friends, of traveling the world. You know, I never wanted to be married. I wanted to have a series of affairs. I never, you know, wanted to live in one place. I just wanted to travel around. And I think the book describes it that the alcoholic is like a tornado running through people's lives. I saw it differently, but... And, you know, I just wanted to travel and be footloose and fancy-free. And so this trip to China was going to kind of be this, you know, my start in this world I wanted to live in. Of course, what ended up happening was that this broad, colorful life I wanted just ended up becoming this really small, tiny life. Towards the end, the last couple of years of my drinking, my life was so narrowly circumscribed by my alcoholism. It was just this little triangular existence. The bars that I drank at, the bar I worked at, and my apartment. So I took this trip, and I was very uncomfortable because I couldn't drink the way I was used to drinking. I didn't, you know, really realize that, and I kind of had to keep a handle on my drinking. And I came back from that trip, maybe not consciously, but certainly subconsciously, knowing there wasn't going to be any more trips like that for me. Because, like I said, my life now was, you know, as Karen says, that alcohol was telling me what to do. I wasn't telling it what to do. That kind of marked the last couple of years of my drinking, which really was just kind of desperation drinking. I ended up drinking in the what we call the hostess bars, or the Korean bars, the strip bars in Honolulu, because we seek lower companions. I did not work there simply because by the time I hit there, I didn't have the self-esteem to ask for a job. But I could look at those women and say, well, at least I'm not doing that. And nothing in there was going to interfere with my drinking because, you know, I couldn't go to the clubs anymore. I just embarrassed myself too many times. And then plus people, you know, want you to do things like dance. And that cuts into my drinking time. And those bars are really, really dark, and the booths are really high. and they're open until 4 a.m. and they reopen at 6 a.m. And I started to get really worried about those 2 hours of downtime in there. You know how when you're drinking, really starts to get to be a lot of work. And my plan was, because the liquor store stopped selling at midnight, so you have to, you know, arrange all this. And I would run downstairs. There's a liquor store under the bar that I worked at, and just before midnight, I get a couple little airplane bottles of vodka to keep with me just in case I wasn't where I needed to be between 4 and 6 a.m., and that is not social drinking as I've come to understand it. I lived in an apartment that was much like the house that I grew up in, but it was worse. We had, when I got sober, in fact, the first phone call that I made to AA was from a payphone. Because our phone had been cut off, and it was from a payphone in front of a liquor store that I could no longer go in because I was prideful and I humiliated myself drunk in there. And when I couldn't go in that liquor store anymore, the next closest place, because I stopped driving after I crashed that car because all of it interferes with your drinking, and my world got so small. But I would have to get to the next nearest liquor store, I'd run across the freeway off-ramp and scramble up an embankment and cut through a hole in a chain link fence. And, you know, that never occurred to me that there was anything odd about that, you know, that I just thought, well, you just kind of have to adjust. And we had louvered windows in that apartment, and the bottom five or six were always broken out, and it was near an empty lot. There was a vacant lot, and there was all these wild cats that lived in the lot, and they'd come in through those windows, and they'd spray all over and get in our trash. And we had this enormous wet spot by the front door. This is my alcoholic sister and I and my nephew, and that's probably the saddest thing about that, that there was a child in that home. I can remember coming home one time and I don't know if I was supposed to be watching him or my sister, but, you know, he'd always say when I'd be going to work or something, you know, who's going to watch me? Who's going to watch me? You know, I'm a teacher today. Children don't say that normally. They, if they have a sense of security. And I can remember coming home and I was drunk and he was there alone. It was dark. And he wasn't tall enough to turn the lights on, but he was trying to make himself something to eat. He had a frozen loaf of bread and a jar of jelly. You know, I love that child. I would never want to harm him. That's alcoholism. That is alcoholism. Anyway, back to the wet spot. We had this huge wet spot. I guess people call plumbers. I know they do now. We couldn't figure that out then. And right by the front door, something leaked under there. But, you know, I would just come in and, drop my purse and leap over the wet spot and get the cash out and pass out on the floor of that apartment. I was experiencing all the physical manifestations of our disease towards the end. I was about 84 pounds when I got sober. I was, the whites of my eyes were yellow, my hair was falling out, my gums were receding from malnutrition. I was hearing voices and things calling on my skin. And, you know, I didn't know that was alcoholism, and I was so grateful to find out it was, because I was in that untenable place where I didn't, you know, you can't live with alcohol and you can't live without it. That married boyfriend of mine was starting to not want to come over anymore because of the way that I lived, and I just thought he was paranoid, you know. And he came over one afternoon. I'd been drunk and cut open my ankle and was drunk at the hospital, and they stitched it up, and they could see, I guess, that I could self-medicate, and so they didn't give me anything for the pain, and I was kind of in pain and out of it, hung over the next day, and he came over and he said, you know, look at your ankle, and that place where the stitches were was just black with fleas. And I kind of dine out on that story a lot, I guess, but if I ever think there's any glamour left in a cocktail for me, or, you know, that it's inconvenient for me to answer my phone for a newcomer or show up for, you know, give someone a ride or drive out to the Pomona Alano Club to give a talk on a Friday night or something, I can just call that image to mind, and because that's how I lived as a practicing woman alcoholic, and that's what's waiting for me. That day came for me when just, you know, nothing was working anymore. It was one of those vodka bottle in the freezer mornings, and I couldn't stop the voices, and I'd have these horrible, horrible alcohol poisoning hangovers. I would just stand over the sink with the dry heat and try and keep some water drops on my tongue, and my head would just race over and over and over. It would say, normal people don't do this, normal people don't do this, normal people don't do this. And I guess the difference between that day and others was that I started to pray. I was so desperate that I began to pray, and that prayer led me to that payphone at the liquor store, and I called my boss. I had no one in my life really at this time, and his wife had just been released from the hospital with the DTs, and so I thought he'd be a good person to call, and he was always kind of a good shoulder to cry on. And he came over and looked at, you know, took a look at me, and I was sick and shaking, and he said, you know, you need a drink, and, you know, let's go get a drink. I think he was probably an alcoholic as well. And I guess it was the prayer, but I said to him, no, take me to the hospital. And that was, the best thing I could come up with, because I didn't know, you know, where people went. And he did that, and what I was hoping was maybe a little sympathy and, you know, maybe some tranquilizers. I got neither, and I'm really grateful. I got a doctor who I thought was very cruel at the time, but I'm very grateful to him. He said to me, you know what, you're an alcoholic, you're an addict, and I can't help you. And I'm really grateful that he did not medicalize my problem, because he was right. He did not have an answer for me, and what he did was he gave me phone numbers it's kind of blurry, but I believe it was to AA and to some treatment centers. The other significant thing that happened in that emergency room was that I saw a nurse before I saw him, and I said to her, you know, I can probably stop the cocaine, but I can't stop drinking. And my secret was out. I can't stop drinking. And she said, you know, my boyfriend's an alcoholic, and he goes to AA. And it was not one alcoholic relating to another, but I really believe that I took the first step in that moment. I just kind of laid it down, and someone else knew my secret, and my journey here began. And like I said, I didn't come here and feel like I was home. I found myself in my first AA meeting, and I was so absolutely terrified. I'd see you guys laughing and talking and smiling, and I would think, I'm never going to feel like that. I'm never going to laugh like that. I'm never going to be comfortable in my skin like that. My eyes will never, you know, you'd look right in my eyes, and that was really hard for me. And I'd come right at the stroke of 8, and I would leave as soon as the meeting was over, and I would hide in the bathroom during the coffee break. And the one thing I did right was that I went consistently to the same. I got a home group. I didn't really realize I was doing it, but that was the Steps to Freedom group that met on Tuesday nights in Honolulu. And I went to that meeting every Tuesday night. And, you know, when I was new, they used to say, hang with the winners. And that ended up happening for me, not because I sought those people out. I didn't know what a winner was, but because those people sought me out. And, of course, that's exactly what made them winners. And all of those people are still sober today. And you know, they talked about, you know, the steps and sponsorship and being sat on that for way too long. I was just so terribly, terribly afraid. You know, I didn't want to open what I called my anxiety closet. I had all that stuff in there, and I didn't want to open that up. But, you know, I finally did it. And of course, I didn't get what I wanted. I wanted, like, Ben Hur music and, you know, the sky to open up. And I didn't get that. What I got, I guess, is that I felt like I had a seat here among you, and I felt like when you looked me in the eye, I didn't have to be afraid of what you're going to see. And there's an Al-Anon that I love dearly, the Noyes, and she says that every alcoholic woman has that little piece of white velvet in her that's never been touched. And that's really kind of, you know, that's a really big deal for us Catholic girls. And I felt like I had that little piece of white velvet in me that had never been touched. And when I had about 3 years of sobriety, I moved to Los Angeles. I got a plan, as we often do, I guess, around 3 years, and that's what happened for me. And I was told by the old timers in Hawaii that the fellowship in Southern California was very large, and that I should get a home group right away and go consistently to the same meetings, because it would be really easy to kind of get lost. And that was my plan. But that's not what happened for me, because I got into a very dangerous place for an alcoholic, and that's judgment. Not that I don't still do it today, but I'm better at it, I think. I couldn't hear the message, because, you know, I guess wherever you get sober, that's the definitive AA for you. And they didn't do it in Los Angeles the way they did it in Honolulu. Of course, now I think that Honolulu does it wrong, you know, but I don't think anyone does it wrong. My life depends on what goes on in these rooms, so I'm the one that needs to adjust. But it wasn't like it was there, what ended up happening was I was sponsorless for about a year and a half, and I mean, it just horrifies me to think about it now, and I would drop in at different meetings just kind of, you know, when the heat was really on, and I ended up going up north a lot, back up to where I was from. I had met up with a lot of old friends, most of whom were junkies, and I had hooked up with a heroin dealer that I met in the park, and I was helping him spend his money, and I was coming up on my 5th grade birthday, and I knew I was in a lot of trouble, a great deal of trouble. And a friend of mine had heard this woman speak, Karen, and he knew that I was looking for a sponsor, and he said, you know, just ask this woman to be your sponsor, and I think she'd be a good sponsor for you. And I didn't, you know anything about Karen, and I went to her and asked her to sponsor me, and I, you know, related all the problems that I'd acquired in a year and a half without a sponsor, and I, you know, told her all the things that I thought was wrong with the meetings that I went to, and she responded rapidly, I might add. She said, honey, that's great, because I didn't, and, you know, I couldn't, she just knew just what to do with me. She said, honey, I expect a lot from the people I sponsor. With your amount of sobriety, I want you to go to 4 meetings a week and get commitments with all of them. I want you to start answering phones at central office. I want you to get a panel. I want you to do another 4th and 5th step with me. I want you to call me on a daily basis. I want you to start sponsoring other women. I want you to get involved with your A sisters, with the other women I sponsored. And I thought, I have clearly picked the wrong sponsor. I'll tell you, her solutions had absolutely nothing to do with my problems. But I could not call to mind one of those problems today, because they died of neglect is what happened. And, you know, Karen knew exactly what to do with me, because one more time it was like I was new again. I would see you guys, I was on the outside of there looking in. I'd see you guys laughing and talking and smiling. I said, I'm never going to feel like that. I'm never going to be comfortable in my skin like that, you know. I've seen AA from the fringes, and I've seen it from the middle, and for me, I prefer the view from the middle. And that's, you know, for someone who's fearful and intense and can't ever accomplish anything, I am really at my best when I'm in the middle of you. There's no doubt about that. And Karen knew that that's exactly what needed to happen, is get me in the middle of the room. You know, as a result of doing all that stuff, of course, I built a very strong foundation. It's one that I stand on today, and it feels really good to stand on solid ground when you're, you know, kind of a scaredy cat. I started, you know, doing those things that she asked me to do. And one of the things that I did that 4th and 5th step, and, you know, and there was some, you know, I acquired some new records in sobriety, one of which was this heroin dealer boyfriend had left a jacket with me, and, I knew where he got it. Someone had stolen it and traded it to him for drugs, and I sold it. And I was up at my family's house at Christmas, and he called me. He had just gotten out of jail and was living on the streets, and asked me if I had his jacket, if I could, you know, bring it to him. And I just panicked, and I just hung up the phone and said, you know, just leave me alone. And, you know, but I knew that I knew I had to clean that up, you know. And I knew that Karen would say that, no, you know, we make direct amends whenever possible. I may have called her. I don't remember, but I had gotten $100 bill for Christmas, and that's what I sold the jacket for. And I got in my car I went down to this area, you know, this neighborhood, and I thought, you know, I really shouldn't go down there because the dealers are going to rush the car. And, you know, of course, it hadn't bothered me 4 months before when I was hanging out down there. But, you know, I just said a prayer, and I drove down there, and I've never seen it like that before or since, but there's absolutely no one on the streets. No one was there. I pulled up to a stop sign. He walked out of the store. I called him over. I gave him that money, and I, you know, told him what I had done and sold the jacket. And you know, I was free of that. And that's what's important about that. I said I've got to find a way to live comfortably in my skin. And you know, he can cross my mind, and I don't have to get that, you know, creepy feeling. And I'm grateful that I've learned a way to live here in spite of. You know, I can make mistakes in sobriety, big mistakes, but I have a way to try and amend those. That first step that I did with Karen, one of the significant things that came out of that was I was so ashamed of the fact that I only had an 8th grade education. And she said to me, you know, honey, you can have anything you want to sobriety as long as you're willing to do the work to get it. And, you know, that was the catch, is doing the work to get it. Like I said, I did not know the difference between a fantasy and a plan. I knew there was magic here, no doubt about it. You know, I'd hear these stories, and I was living in a garage, and I'm a lawyer. And you just think, oh, that's, you know, it's a miracle. And, you know, and it is, but there's some work in between there. And you know, I was just going to, you know, sit here and wait for it to come to me. And Karen said, no, honey, that God only does for us what we can't do for ourselves, and you've got to do the rest. And why don't you go and get your high school diploma and take that GED exam. And I thought that was, you know, of course I didn't tell her this, but I thought I was really, I mean, really. One, you know how we are. It's, perfection or nothing. On the one hand, I absolutely knew that I couldn't pass it. And on the other hand, I thought, you know, a high school diploma, I mean, how about a PhD? I mean, you know, it just seems so insignificant. But I did it, and that was something I learned a big lesson for that. I was convinced that it wouldn't work, that it had nothing to do with anything. But what was important was that I did it in spite of what my motives were or what I thought the results were going to be. And much to my surprise, I passed, and at 28 years old, I became a high school graduate. That was a really big deal for me. It really was. I have written that off as wreckage of the past, and I'm so grateful for a sponsor who is objective enough. You know, I couldn't see that would have anything, you know, to do with making me feel better or anything, but she knew that was something important to me, and that she made me go and face that and take care of that. And I started, she told me, you know, why don't you start going, taking some classes, and I started doing that at a little community college, Pasadena City College, and I started with one class at a time, and I was, you know, so scared. I was older than most people, And I learned a lot. I thought, why can't I go to school? I don't know anything. And of course, now I know that, you know, that's why you go. You don't have to know at first. But that kept me out for a long time. And now I'm in a position to pass that information on. But I would just be terrified. But the one thing that I did right above all else is that I showed up. I showed up on the days I was too dumb and the days I was too smart and every day in between, of which, you know, there's probably like 2 days in between. But I just showed up because I learned how to do that here first because I've always been a runner. And I can remember calling Karen from a phone booth there on that campus one morning just saying, I can't walk in there. I can't do it. I just, you know, the fear would just seize me. And she'd say with love, you get in there and don't you call me until you do, bam. And in I go. I was at that school for about 3 years, and I ended up with about three jobs there. They weren't big deals for anybody but me, but I was my first job there. It was like a $6-an-hour tutoring job, but I was 29. It was my first job above minimum wage and beyond physical labor, and that was, I started to imagine a way out of what I saw as kind of the trap, the kind of career trap that I was in. And I did not go in there with any big goals or anything. I just would, Karen would say, honey, just do the next indicated action. And that really works well for me. Because what happens is I get this big picture of how it's going to be and what it's going to be like, and then I don't meet it. And then, halfway there, I say, forget it. What was I thinking anyway? That was not the first community college I had gone to. It was the third. But eventually I ended up with enough units to transfer, and Karen asked me, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd like to go to a major university. I wanted to go to UCLA. Karen, is a nurse there, and I wanted to go to UCLA. And she said, well, start doing the footwork to do that. But I could not meet their math requirement. And I took the same, I spent a year taking the same math class three times and having to withdraw before I failed. And I did it all. I mean, it was like math anxiety tapes and tutors and anything that was available. I just kept hitting my head against the same wall. And we talked a lot here about doing footwork. And so I went and got myself tested for a learning disability. And I was told that I had a very severe learning disability. I tested as far as the quantitative reasoning in the second percentile. And, I don't know very much about numbers, but I know that's low. There's only one number under that. And I was told by the doctor that tested me that, I would not have a university education, and that her words, in fact, were that, UCLA will not even, let you on the property until you can meet their math requirement, and that I should set my sights lower. Maybe vocational school is what she suggested, or a non-accredited school. But you know what? Nobody in AA told me that, and my sponsor didn't tell me that. I think we're more well-versed in extraordinary circumstances than a learning disability specialist. Karen said, honey, you just keep knocking on doors and you just keep trying. And I found out that sometimes no means I don't know. And I'm also in a position now to give that information away, that sometimes you're going to meet people that, when you're in school that they can have wrong information and you need to just keep going. And And so against this woman's advice and against my counselor's advice, I applied to UCLA, and it's a good thing I was accepted because it was the only school I applied to. That was the best that I could do. And in June of 97, I got to put on a cap and gown for the first time in my life. I was 33 years old, and I graduated magna cum laude. And I got to give the commencement address at that graduation. And it was a really wonderful day. And probably the best part about that day was that, my mom, my parents were there. My mom got to sit in the VIP section, and, she had her scholar back. And, she knows where I am today. She knows where I am this weekend. She doesn't, have to worry about me. I cannot take back those nights, when she laid awake wondering where I was and that kind of thing. I cannot, how do you fix that? But Karen always told me to be kind, and she used to tell me, I'm really glad that I never had, I didn't have the kind of sponsorship that, she didn't say things like, go home and make sure you take care of you and, put yourself at the top of your men's list. She'd say, honey, go home and be of service to your family. And sometimes that's hard to do in an alcoholic home, but, my mom doesn't want to hear about, how sorry I am for the things I did when I was drinking. But she really likes when I do things like open the door for her, or take her on her errands, or, let her know where I am, or send her a card. I had to learn that here. That was a wonderful day. And, I got to, there was a VIP reception ahead of time at that graduation, and they had an academic robing ceremony where they dressed the professors in their regalia from, wherever they've gotten their PhDs from, Harvard or what have you, and they're dressing them. And the other speaker was one of Clinton's ambassadors to the Middle East, and then, here I come, and, my guests were an old timer from my home group, a guy who did, 27 years in the penitentiary, and, Karen, a woman who, came out of a blackout walking naked down a highway, and I thought, God, if they only knew. But I'll tell you what, that exotic coterie of friends I've always wanted, I'm standing right in the middle of you, and I would not have it any other way. I absolutely love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love that about our fellowship. There's nothing like it. There's nothing else like it. I put a lot of expectations on that degree. I didn't really realize it at the time. But in retrospect, and I don't, I'm really happy that I got it, and it changed my life, but it's not a cure for alcoholism. And, me still kind of living in that fantasy world, I thought, I'll be confident all the time. I won't feel like the truck driver's daughter anymore, I still have, like I said, the forces that brought me here are still with me, I still have fear, I still have anxiety, I don't get any dispensation from reality here, or from human emotions. For a long time, I think I labored under the delusion that you come to AA and you're going to feel good all the time, and that's just not the case. And I had a really rough time after I graduated because, I kind of thought that I was owed something. Big mistake. And I just had a rough time. I couldn't get a job, I was just scared. I was really scared. And I thought, maybe I'll just go and get a waitress job for the summer. And I knew that if I did that, I would, I'd never get out. I couldn't do that. And I finally, a lot of things, it was a really rough time for me. I ended up changing sponsors, and that was a very difficult thing for me. My sponsor here is a woman named Marion, and it was just a very rough time. I finally took this job teaching phonics to kindergartners, because what I wanted to do is I wanted to teach for a year and then go to graduate school and get a master's degree. That was my plan. And then teach community college English. And I took this job teaching phonics to kindergartners, and I was so terrified. I mean, I was just terrified. And I called Mary and said, I'm going to call in sick. I can't. She'd say, if you do that, you'll never walk in a classroom again. And she was right, and I had reasons to be afraid. They say things like, is that your real hair? Because you look like you have some other hair underneath. And that job ended. It was just part-time. And it's a good thing I did that, because my next job was really scary to me. I graduated in June, and from June until January, a girlfriend of mine in the program, her name's Lisa, kept saying to me, you know, we really need a teacher. You know, where I work is down at Perry Middle School, Special Ed Middle School, LA Unified. You know, please come and will you come and take the job? I know you can do it. And I thought, you know, absolutely not. Two things I will never teach are Special Ed in middle school. No way. And no LA Unified. And where is Gardena? Yeah, and not exactly a garden spot of Southern California. It's not the worst area, certainly, but... And I'm, you know, I'm praying, and I'm turning it over, and I'm saying, you know, God, show me where I'm supposed to serve, and I'm, you know, and I'm willing, and all this time, you know, months, my friend Lisa's just, you know, at me about taking this job. You know, I had no idea that God did such a good impression on my friend Lisa, what happened, and I made the fatal error, well, fortuitous, actually, of mentioning that job to my sponsor, Marion, and I said, you know, well, there's this one job I could get, but it's Special Ed Middle School for LA Unified. Nobody wants to teach that, which is true. And that's why I can get the job. And I felt this froth come over the phone. And she said, you know, as the mother of a former special ed student, I think you could really be of service there. And I think you know in your heart that that's where you're supposed to be. And, you know, the minute she said that, I did know in my heart that that's where I was supposed to be. But that was not the answer that I wanted, you know. It's just that's not what I wanted. You know, when I'm praying for the fear to be removed, I just want it to be removed. Don't send me to 163rd in Normandy, you know, between south of west and east of Compton, west of Compton, to walk through the fear and, you know, just take it away. But that's not how it works. And it was exactly, you know, so I took that job, and it was just like, you know, and I tried to tell my friend Lisa, I have no training teaching special ed. And she said, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best training I've ever had for teaching special ed. And, and she has been absolutely right about that, I'll get to that in a minute. Most of what works in my classroom are things that I learned here, and you know, and it was just like what I thought. I mean, they just hand me the key and say it's down there. And these students that I came in February, they had not had a teacher since September. You know, these are not kids who do well without, their lives are already in chaos. They've got, you know, big, big problems. They, you know, they live in group homes, and they've been, you know, abused, and big problems. You know, parents who have been murdered, all kinds of stuff. They live in motel rooms, what have you, and I was just so scared and so overwhelmed with their problems and thinking, like, how, you know, and they couldn't, most of them, you know, they were sixth graders, they couldn't read, of course they hadn't had a teacher all year. You know, we had no books, we had metal detectors, of course, but no books, and it was just hideous, and, you know, they'd be wanting my attention, I'd be thinking, you know, not now, I'm thinking about how awful this all is. I mean, it was just, I just got so, and, you know, finally I just realized, you know, my sponsor said, you know, there's no, you can't fix that, you have no, you know, cure for that. I just thought, you know, I'm just going to do for them, if I can do for them what you do for me, which is, you know, you give me a place to come to. You know, when I come to a meeting, the lights are on and the chairs are set up, the coffee is made, I know what's going to happen here. You give me a place to come to, you're kind to me, you remember my name, you tell me to come back. And in spite of all the chaos and all the insanity that we bring through the doors, sanity prevails in the room. And, you know, I thought, well, that's what I know how to do. And so that's what I, you know, started trying to do in my classroom. And, of course, you know, it turned out to just be, you know, exactly what those kids need. And when I left there to go to graduate school, you know, they all wrote me letters. And, you know, they said things like, I love you like my mom. And, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to tell my kids about you. Or, you know, you're like my best friend at this school because you gave me paper when I didn't have any. And, you know, I didn't know that a piece of paper was, you know, would do it. I'm always, you know, thinking of, you know, try to be bigger, better. And like I said, I wanted to go to graduate school. I had my plan, and I did that. I was accepted to Stanford a couple years ago and into the Master's in English program. And that was just a, you know, fantastic gift. And it meant moving away from the AA that I knew for a year and moving up north. And but I knew what to do this time. I didn't go to meetings and compare. I went to meetings. I got jobs to do there, and I just hooked in quickly, and it was a, you know, it was a wonderful opportunity. And when I was accepted there, my mom is not very effusive or, you know, can't really express herself emotionally very well, but when she sent me a card that said, I'm just as proud as punch, and whatever happened to that girl that dropped out of high school and went to work as a waitress, and, you know, of course, she came to you, and you've really given her a fantastic life. And I, like I said, I wanted to teach community college English, and I had an opportunity to do that. I wanted a full-time job, and I didn't get it. But I got a part-time job, and last year I was back at the community college where Karen sent me, you know, 6-7 years before to take one class, and I was on the staff of that English department, and they even call me Professor McCray. I wasn't one, but I'll take it. I had an opportunity. I would see people, you know, my first night standing in front of a class, teaching a class, you know, and I thought I'll dress myself like a teacher costume and, you know, pull the wool over their eyes. And this young man came up to me, and it was just like looking at myself 6 years before. He was just terrified. He could barely, you know, and you could tell he probably, you know, he had like, you know, we can read the map. He had like tattoos and, you know, kind of not a shady character, but I think he'd been around the block. And he was just terrified to be there. And it was just, you know, amazing. I was able to kind of, you know, relate a little bit of my experience. And it just, you know, I was able to identify with those students, and it was great. And but full time, I work at 163rd and Normandy at Perry Middle School teaching special ed. And because I found, you know, and I, it was hard for me to let that plan go, you know, because I thought, you know, I mean, because my ego got involved, you know. Well, you know, UCLA, Stanford, and then, you know, Perry Middle School, home of the Huskies. Like, this cannot be right. But I tell you what, you know, when I'm there, I don't want to be anywhere else. I'm not waiting for my real life to start. I'm not watching the clock. I'm not, you know, thinking, you know, someday I'll get a good job. I get to feel comfortably and usefully whole. And I never had that before in my work life. And it's just, you know, it's just fantastic, and it's a really good deal. When Karen wanted me to get involved with the other women she sponsored, my AA sisters, I thought that was a hideous idea, and as far as I was concerned, there were just people in my way when I wanted to get to my sponsor. And I'll tell you, I'm so glad that she insisted on that, because even though we're not all sponsored by, that, you know, we have different, some of us have different sponsors, what have you, there is a bond there. And I never really knew how to kind of have connections with women very well, and I'm really grateful for that. And one Christmas we did a potluck at my house, and now every year Karen takes the girl she sponsors at Christmas, and they go somewhere like, you know, Vegas or Palm Springs, and they have a weekend retreat. But this is the first year we're doing a potluck at my house, and I just thought, you know, it's ridiculous. I wanted to cancel, but I couldn't do that. And everybody showed up, and you know, I'm one of those people. I'm always looking in. You know, I go by houses, and I'm always looking in windows, and you know, looking at someone else's life. It always looks, you know, so good, and you know what other people are doing. And I was looking around my living room, you know, and I got to open my door and open my home to those people. I didn't have to worry about how I lived. You know, I didn't live in squalorous conditions anymore. And you know, those women were in there, and we were eating and cleaned up and having our meeting, and I thought, you know, I wonder what my life looks like. And when nobody was looking, I went outside and I looked through my dining room window, and my life looked so good. It looked so good. Of course, probably the best part of that was I was not the center of that picture. And anybody could have driven by and said, you know, wow, you know, look at those people, you know, look at those women. And it's just such a good deal that we have here. I think I'm going to stop here. I don't, you know, want to keep fishing for things to say. Again, I just, you know, I want to welcome you if you're new. Please stay with us. It's been my experience that everything that I thought that A was going to take from me, A is given to me. And I'm just very, very happy to be here. I want to thank you so much for listening so quietly. Most importantly, I want to thank you for my life.